ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me is my co-host, Mr. Chad Indiana Riley.
Hello, hello.
Chad is
fresh
been,
off the plane.
True. Chad was on a week-long vacation with family on the other side of the nation and decided that, you know what, he loved this podcast so much that he had to be back today so that he could be a part of today's show.
Yeah, that was a mistake. What was I thinking?
Oh, but we did, even though we were
I jest.
Yeah. No, even though we were on opposite sides of the country, though, we did band together and figure out that we needed to do a movie review today. And so he saw the movie on his side of the world, and I saw the movie on my side of the world, or nation.
I was going to say, Indiana and California are not that far apart.
They're far enough to keep us apart.
I mean,
for
a couple
Christmas.
Thousand miles.
They kept it apart. They kept us apart for
it's
Christmas.
True.
Sad. But we got an exciting show for you today, and we got a great movie to talk about. It's been a really interesting day with a lot of movie news and a lot of things going on. So, you know what? We're going to talk about a couple of those things once we hit our movie news and get into the movie. The Filmlosophers is presented at 24 frames per second by Mingle Media TV and recorded live at VGB Studios. Although Christmas is just getting smaller in the rearview mirror, it's still the most wonderful time of the year. Which is why we encourage you to give the gift of the Filmlosophers podcast to friends and family. Subscription is free and available on all their favorite platforms. New episodes are available every week on Google Play, Audioboom, iTunes, Player FM, Stitcher, and Libsyn. Our social media pages are the stocking stuffer you never realized you were craving. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 to chat about movie news throughout the week and connect with other Filmlosophy fans. Finally, to access all of the amazing podcasts from VGB Studios, visit our website at vgbstudios.com. There, you'll find the entire episode library for the Filmlosophers, Video Game Bang, and me, Mike, Self, and I.
So many goodies.
So many goodies.
So little time.
But of course, before we get into anything, we gotta hit the movie news. And we got some sad news to pass along as news came about today, which is December 26th.
27th?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right, 27th, that Carrie Fisher has passed away at the age of 60. After a four-day battle in the hospital following her in-flight heart attack on December 23rd, Carrie Fisher passed away this morning. Family spokesperson Simon Halls released a statement on behalf of Fisher's daughter, Billy Lord. It is with a very deep sadness that Billy Lord confirms that her beloved mother, Carrie Fisher, passed away at 8:55 this morning. She was loved by the world and she will be missed profoundly. Our entire family thanks you for your thoughts and prayers. Fisher was 60 years old, known famously for her iconic role as Princess Leia in the Star Wars trilogy. Fisher was more than that. She was an accomplished novelist, actress, and visionary. She wrote many novels as well as her memoir, Wishful Drinking, in 2008, which later became a one-woman play. Her recent memoir, The Princess Diarist, is already a bestseller.
And likely to sell quite a lot more.
Yeah.
You know, given this news, lots of fans worldwide. Obviously, true. Star Wars is like the film franchise.
Yeah.
You know, I almost went Lord of the Rings, the one to save them all or whatever. But obviously, very iconic. Mm. A lot of the what people gravitate to in the character of Princess Leia comes really from her as a performer.
Yeah.
The courage that she portrayed in the role, you know, given the climate of the times and needing to have that strong female counterbalance to a whole bunch of dudes.
Yeah.
You know, because there aren't really that many, even now. I mean, even look at Rogue One, there's one strong female, mm-hmm. some other side characters that are female, and then a bunch of dudes. Mm-hmm. So there is, you know, Princess Leia really as a character set a precedent for,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, having that strong presence in front of the camera. And that is probably 99% due to the woman playing her.
True. Carrie Fisher, to a lot of people in the industry that we currently work in terms of movies and Hollywood, Carrie Fisher was more than just a icon. She was a role model for a lot of people, for a lot of young women, a lot of young girls. I've been scouring Facebook all day, and a lot of people that we know are just in utter sadness as this person whom was a physical hero to them, not just because of what she did on stage or in a performance on the big screen, but also because of what she stood for, what she did outside of film, what she did outside of, you know, Hollywood. And so you can really see how her life in itself was a beacon of just inspiration for a lot of people. And it's all over Facebook. If you haven't, you know, really been on Facebook at all today, or Twitter, or any social media, just hop on and you'll see what people are saying. John Campia from Collider.com had a very heartful 9-minute video that he did while he was out in some other state. He was with family for the holidays. Kevin Smith did a really beautiful little excerpt on his Instagram with a picture of him, Jason Mewes, and her. Not to mention all the great things that a lot of the cast from Star Wars themselves are saying in her memory on social media. We haven't really heard anything quite yet from Harrison Ford, whom probably had the closest relationship, I would say possibly, out of everybody on the cast.
Well, especially in light of, you know, some recent developments. He did issue a statement after she went into the hospital, but
yeah.
As far as we know, as of recording this podcast episode, he has not issued a public statement over her passing, nor has Mark Hamill that I know of.
Yeah. So
it's interesting. You know, it does very sad news, and you know, it's one of those things that you hear it and you're sad for the family, and you're sad for friends and close loved ones, you know, of hers. And then also, you know, you have this big question mark for the franchise, because of the three, you know, main characters from the original films, Han, Luke, and Leia. Well, Han, spoiler alert, Han is gone as of The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
Luke hasn't said anything yet, although you've seen him.
True.
On a hillside, but there's been no, you know, dialogue yet. Mm-hmm. You know, Leia as a character was factoring in to be a prominent force in this new trilogy.
Yeah.
So it'll, you know, obviously it's not the time to figure that out, but it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the filmmakers do.
Yeah.
You know, with the real life circumstances, you know, with the actress. So,
and it's
and as goes with anybody, I mean, this is always, whenever you're a studio and you're thinking about multi-picture deals, I mean, think about these DC characters, these Marvel characters you're signing on. Some of them are signed on for 5 or 7 or 9 films.
Yeah.
Obviously, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, you look even at Anton Yelchin in, you know, with the Star Trek franchise. They had not, the film was done in post-production, you know, when what happened to him happened to him. And, you know, there's no need to immediately figure out how they're going to kind of tell their story without his character.
Yeah.
Or if, you know, but, you know, it's an interesting thing to consider from a business standpoint, you know, when you have these large contracts and you, you know, settle these characters. And think of the, you know, the Harry Potter cast. I mean, they had ultimately, what, 7 movies, 8 movies?
It was 8 movies.
Yeah,
split that last book.
And, you know, Dumbledore had to be recast.
Yeah,
midstream. And so it's interesting.
And you bring up a really good point. Because when these actors or actresses, they get signed on for, like you said, 5-picture deals, 7-picture deals, 9-picture deals, we're not talking years. We're talking pictures. We're talking films. They could be like almost 2 to 3 years in between each film.
Yeah.
If, you know, it takes that much time to get the story going. So you're looking at a longevity of close to 15 to 16 years. And
and obviously they're not going to be recasting Carrie Fisher. That will not happen.
Because that's a
you know, but will they have to take a similar path to what they did with Paul Walker or Philip Seymour Hoffman for, you know, Fast and the Furious or for the Hunger Games.
That's true, sir. Our hearts here at the Filmlosophers, our hearts go out to the families and those that are mourning in this time and are going through it. And we wish you well and peace. And yeah. But moving on, Ridley Scott gives fans a Christmas gift with the Alien Covenant trailer. So on December 24th, Fox released a trailer for Alien Covenant, the sequel to Prometheus. And it definitely has all the makings of a classic alien film. Michael Fassbender is back as the android David, and a team inside the colony ship called the Covenant will soon learn the terror that is the Xenomorph. So,
such an odd juxtaposition, Christmas and this trailer, because
hey,
with Prometheus, the whole movie, let alone the trailer, there was a lot of, let's say they were flirting with, you know, this is in the alien universe, in the mega franchise,
yeah,
that are the alien films. But there wasn't a lot in the trailer. The worst thing about the Prometheus trailer was the soundtrack to it, with the weird screaming, screeching thing that happened. Here we have, you know, Christmas Eve, a new trailer that is quite a bit more down the road of like, no, this is an alien film.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, you see quite a few. I mean, it kind of opens with a bit of a gory scene, mm-hmm. and then you've got this slimy. Yeah, it was an interesting entry to the, you know, yeah. the holiday season.
And I'm not gonna lie, I woke up super excited Christmas Eve to see that my phone had a notification that there was a new trailer released for the film, and I saw it first thing in the morning, and I was super excited. This for me was a really good Christmas gift, and I call it a Christmas gift because of the fact that since Prometheus had came out, not a lot of people had much hope left for the franchise because of the fact of how really far-reaching it's going. We had mentioned that Prometheus on a previous show, that Prometheus was a prequel, but not in the normal sense. It's a prequel that's like maybe three or four times
removed. Yeah, it's quite a bit pre.
Yeah. So,
but we're not sure exactly how pre.
Exactly. And that's that you know, brought up a lot of good questions from a lot of fans, you know, where does all this fall into place with the original storyline that people remember and people love. And so seeing this and seeing like the opening scenes with the face huggers and the egg pods and, you know, seeing the xenomorphs and seeing a lot of the visuals that reminded me of the first and second Alien films, I was excited. I was like, this is exactly what this franchise needs. This is like a jolt of adrenaline to the entire franchise for people who have been thinking, you know, I don't know, I'm not too sure if this is going to be a great franchise still because Prometheus and everything was like all super.
Well, here's the thing with Prometheus, because I did not see the Alien films when they came into theaters. I was too young, and so I didn't see them in theaters. I saw them later down the road, mm-hmm. And so Prometheus to me, there was, from a story standpoint, there was a considerable attempt being made to world build. So
yeah.
The Alien trilogy, the original trilogy, right? It's basically like a intelligent scary movie. I mean, it's mm-hmm. they're just scary movies. There's no need for them to fit into a bigger context story-wise. And what Prometheus was doing was trying to establish, you know, take your big broad brushstrokes and make it a bigger canvas, fit it into a much larger galaxy-wide story or universe-wide story or whatever, with other races in addition to the xenomorphs and a past that you weren't familiar with. And you know, did we help create them maybe? Or, you know, what, like, it was making it something more than what it had been. And I think for that, I applaud the effort for sure.
Yeah.
Although the tone and the feeling of Prometheus didn't have near the level of tension and anxiety and almost that, you know, kind of, in a way, hopeful expectation that something terrible is going to happen.
Yeah.
And then it's going to gross you out. It was much more explorational. It was a different type of story. This film seems to be blending the two together, because you can see a lot in terms of the way the trailer's cut feels very similar to Prometheus.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
In terms of these little, like, you get this little window of a picture into what the scene is going to be in the full length movie, but we're not going to show you too much.
Yeah.
But then what you do see is a lot more in line with what you're expecting.
Yeah. And that's true, because like you were saying, Prometheus was more of like an intellectual, piece rather than just what the original film was all about, which was just, you know, the tagline says it all, you know, in space, no one can hear you scream,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's a lot of fear that goes into that type of thinking, like, oh my gosh, it's right. If, you know, you're in space and something bad happens, you know, who's going to know? And it just works off of that primal fear. It works off of that primal, you know, fear that a lot of people have in terms of, you know, not being able to find help in a place where you are the only person within millions of miles of anything. Mm-hmm. And then you go to Prometheus, and Prometheus is like, but by the way, did you know that the forefathers of the xenomorphs may have actually been the Jesus to whatnot? Because there's so many theories that went around, and it was all just ridiculousness, and you see some of the jock.
This is what happens when you put one of the showrunners of Lost,
yes,
onto this franchise and say, okay, make it more complicated, and then he says, oh, I know how to do complicated because we just did that show. Yeah, they made it a lot more complicated, and more complicated than it needs to be.
Yeah, yeah, and in this one, it just looks simple. It looks like what you would expect from a sequel with Sigourney Weaver. It looks like something where you can actually feel the fear, and you can sense that this film is going to ramp up. And because the trailer, it's insane. It ramps up all the way to the very end, and then it cuts off, and you're like, what happened? Because you're seeing all these glimpses of things, and you're seeing all these little shadows, and you're like, is that a xenomorph? Is that mm-hmm. a facehugger?
No, they're toying with you a lot in this trailer. Yes,
and it's like, really? Really? You can't do that. I've been waiting for, like, so many years. I have to rewatch the original, you know, saga just to kind of get myself back into the flow of it. And then I see this, and I'm like, oh, I almost totally sideswiped all of Christmas just to see the first four again all over. You know, just because it made that much of an impact where you're like, okay, there's hope to go back to what, you know, what made it great in the first place. And you got a great cast. You got, you know, Michael Fassbender, who's returning as David. You have Catherine Waterston, Billy Crudup, Danny McBride. You got a slew of people who are coming back into the fray or coming into the fray as kind of the Michael Biehn character from, you know, the second Alien film, or the Bill Paxton from the second one, or, you know, there's so many different thoughts and vibes that are going into this that bring you back to when you first saw the first one and the second one.
And I like that the only one that we know of, as far as we can see from the cast list, the only one who's returning is Michael Fassbender, because mm-hmm. his character was an android.
Yeah.
So that kind of innately gives you a different dynamic than somebody like Ripley being the through line, you know, that is the character that's in this one and that one and that one.
Yeah.
Like this one, you can destroy him any number of ways, and he could just upload his consciousness into yeah. another version. Like there, and he could learn and adapt as time goes on in ways that a human character couldn't because they're dead, which they are all kind of ending up dead.
Yeah.
That's kind of the point. That's part of the point of the franchise. But
true.
I think that creatively it gives you a lot of options that you didn't have before in terms of telling that longer, bigger story, because in a way you do have a point of view character who is expendable, but then will keep returning. And I also think that Prometheus is going to play better, is going to read better once this is tied to it. Similar to when you do in comic books, you have individual issues that then go together into a collected edition, or, you know, graphic novel format, if you will. And the individual episodes make more sense when they're part of a whole than they do when they're by themselves. And I think that Prometheus is going to end up being that way. Like once they finish stitching together whatever this new trilogy is, and making it, you know, its defined, cohesive story,
yeah.
then that first part is going to make a lot more sense as kind of setting the table, if you will, for the scope of this set of movies, because it is bigger. It's bigger, it's more beautiful, it's, you know, possibly also more horrific and dangerous and, you know, alarming, too. We have yet to see those elements, you know, for the most part. There's a little bit in the climax of Prometheus that's, you know, a bit tense, but for the most part, they're just figuring things out.
True. So we're excited. We hope you're excited. Alien Covenant hits theaters on May 19th, 2017. So,
also known as Eddie's Second Christmas.
Tis true. But that does bring us to our special presentation today as we discuss a very family-friendly, very musical animated film that Illumination put out, and that would be Sing. No, I'm not telling Chad to sing. Trust me, nobody, you know, I don't know if anybody wants to hear that. But, so we gotta get the video going here because we got Chad dancing in the studio.
I mean, come on, this has got a good groove to it.
No, Chad, don't stand on the table. It's okay. See, you guys are missing out.
Bring out my maracas.
This is a really fun film, and it was released this past weekend. And the synopsis of the film, real quick, is dapper koala Buster Moon resides over a once grand theater that has fallen on hard times. An eternal optimist and a bit of a scoundrel, he loves his theater above all and will do anything to preserve it. Facing the crumbling of his life's ambitions, he takes one final chance to restore his fading jewel to its former glory by producing the world's greatest singing competition. Five contestants emerge: a mouse, a timid elephant, a pig, a gorilla, and a punk rock porcupine. Punk rock porcupine.
I didn't hear a word you just said because I was breaking it down with Tori Kelly.
I can hear. Yeah, I was watching you. And
don't you worry about a thing, Eddie.
That's funny. A punk rock porcupine. That seems like a tongue twister.
Punk rock porcupine.
Yeah. Sing, directed by Christopher Lord-Alette and Garth Jennings, stars Matthew McConaughey, Reese Witherspoon, Taron Egerton, Scarlett Johansson, Tori Kelly, Seth MacFarlane, and so many others. This is one of the two films that has been released this year, and it's actually the first time that two Illumination films have been released in the same year. The other film being The Secret Life of Pets, which was released sometime around, I believe, August.
It was high summer. It was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was summertime. It was a summer flick.
Wasn't a summer blockbuster. But
no, not in so many words. And I'm not sure that this is going to be a winter blockbuster in so many words. Aside from it's singing animals, so what's not to love? So obviously it's a no-brainer for parents to take their kids to it. It doesn't have the same... Overall, it doesn't have the same texture and finesse that you would get in like a Pixar film. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more just a fun kids movie, which is fine. There's definitely a market for that.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of, this is the second film for Illumination this year. This is also the one of many anthropomorphic films that we've had so far of this year alone.
So many anthropomorphic films this year.
I mean, I think all the studios got together and they're like, all right, we need a theme for 2016. I know. Let's do anthropomorphic animals.
Well, and by all the theaters, we mean basically Disney and Illumination.
And Illumination.
Because Disney was responsible for, what, 1, 2, 3, 4 of them. So just to recap, we've talked about this before. We did an entire double feature special show way back months ago on Zootopia and Jungle Book. Mm-hmm. But an anthropomorphic paradigm or situation is basically when you have non-human characters behaving like humans. So say, for example, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That's one I don't have on our list here. But you've got full-grown turtle people that eat pizza and talk and do jujitsu or ninjutsu and whatnot and drive vehicles. And so they behave like human beings. So you've had quite a few this year in the family-friendly avenue.
Yeah.
That lane has been populated by a lot of specifically animals behaving like humans. Zootopia, they dressed like people. They had, you know, their whole, you know, city, urban and rural areas of their cities, and they had jobs and they had technology, and they behaved like a modern society, you know, with different little cultural enclaves.
Yeah.
Versus something like Jungle Book, where they actually still behave in many ways like animals, but they speak and relate to one another in humanistic ways.
True. And so this one kind of leans a little bit more towards like Zootopia in that mindset, and the way the city is retrofitted, I guess, for the different types of animals. I mean, you have fish that are going to school up the stairs on like a little pond or a little river that's mm-hmm. running up the steps. And you have a lot of those little things that are made for, you know, the different types of animals. So, but what was your initial review after you left the theaters when you saw the film?
You know, my biggest, and this was one of those, I went and saw this film and I saw it in the movie theater that I grew up going to. One my hometown had two smaller ones and then kind of combined into one bigger one. And so this is the bigger one. So, but still, I mean, that was middle school for me that happened, I believe. So it's the movie theater I've gone to. Number one, thank you, Indiana, for having lower ticket prices. That made my day.
You mind if, but mind if I ask how much you
paid? $6.
For
evening.
For a 2D. Weekend or a weekday?
Yeah, it was a weekend. It was Christmas Day.
Oh, wow.
The evening of Christmas.
$6?
$6, yeah.
I paid that just today just because it was a Tuesday and it was before 6 o'clock or before 5 o'clock.
Right. No, so it's it's pretty nice, at least at that theater. I don't know that every theater
get on
still
board,
has
Sacramento.
It that low. But you know, so it was kind of that whole like throwback, flashback to the theater that one of the theaters I grew up going to when I was much younger, and you know, every once in a while when I'm home, I go back, and it was a family friendly movie, and so I kind of was in like almost young Chad mode. I was in kid mode, right? I was ready to go and see this movie with some family members and be impressed with all the singing. You know, you and I and your wife, Doris, enjoy singing competitions on television, True. The reality TV, you know, The Voice, American Idol, all that kind of stuff. We like to sit there and appreciate and critique where necessary.
That's true.
So I had a lot of expectations. And I will say that the movie didn't meet my expectations in so much as there's not as much singing as I was expecting in a movie called Sing.
Mm-hmm.
There's an awful lot of just normal movie storytelling. And so that, I think, it diminished my experience. It's not that it's a bad film. It actually was very enjoyable. I think it had too many subplots. You got your A line, your B line, your C line. This one has like a D, E, and F line.
Yeah, I was going to say it goes pretty deep.
Because it's trying to follow too many of the characters and tell a complete story for each of them. So I think that there were too many storylines going on and not enough singing.
True. And I agree wholeheartedly. This film, although it, like Chad said, although it's titled Sing, that was kind of the C subplot for the entire...
Yeah, the singing thing. Really wasn't...
It wasn't at the forefront.
The focus,
yeah.
For some reason.
You know, you had a lot of A-list actors and actresses in the film. And, you know, impressively enough, most of them did all their own singing.
Vocals, yeah.
You know... vocals. So that's impressive to
and
say.
And they're good.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know that they've done some things with them, but I mean, they're really good. They're solid performances.
Yes. But I like you said, I did think that this did skimp out on the whole utilizing the title of Sing. It just seemed to really try so many different things all in one type of film, all in one storyline. I thought the idea of, you know, having Matthew McConaughey, for one, which, you know, anybody who listens to the show know I'm a huge fan of, but I couldn't really see eye to eye with his character. Rosita, having a pig with the name of Rosita, played by Reese Witherspoon, that's a whole another conversation all in itself. You know, I thought that they had a great lineup, but I don't think that they really thought it through in terms of who they were bringing to the voice talent, whose voice talent they were bringing up to the screen. Well, and
it's interesting because so much of, I oftentimes, it's sort of my default setting to go back to the script, go back to the page, the piece of paper that has ink on it that says, this is what character A says, that's what character B says, here's the action that's happening while they're talking. And I think that, interestingly enough, in spite of the fact that this is a kid's movie, so much of the story actually belongs to non-childlike behavior. So the main character is Buster Moon, this koala bear. Mm-hmm. Matthew McConaughey does the voice. He falls in love with the theater. Eventually, as he's growing up, his father owns a car wash, saves up all his money, buys the theater once it's available, so that his son can take it over. And then his son turns out to not be a very good businessman. He doesn't pull in the right shows, and the theater is failing.
Yeah.
And he can no longer honor his father's memory. He's in default on his loans with the bank. He's in default. He hasn't paid his electric bill. I mean, all these adult situations are happening.
Yeah.
And that, for whatever reason, gets a lot of the focus of the storyline of the film, is essentially Buster the Koala has to con his way into hopefully getting people to like the theater again, so he's not ashamed, you know, in his late father's memory or whatever.
Yeah.
So he develops this singing competition with money he doesn't have. Then his dear sweet old chameleon receptionist, Mrs. Crawley, accidentally types some extra zeros into the dollar amount.
Yes.
So the prize is even bigger than the amount that he doesn't have to begin with. And so everybody's applying, you know, American Idol style or whatever, what have you, and auditioning and trying out and all of this, and they're expecting a bigger prize than is even available.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you've got the bank breathing down his neck. I mean, there were just so many non-singing elements that were driving the story. And in the meantime, you've got characters that are, you know, either likable or not, who all have, you know, some stake in winning the prize money. They either need to, they need the money for something, or they need the notoriety for something, or they're trying to prove something to themselves by just following through on the impulse to try out in the first place.
Yeah.
And so you've got all of their storylines all working at the same time. And at some point, everyone behind the scenes thought, yeah, let's go ahead and, you know, stick with the defaulting on the loan stuff. And how do you try to con other people into bringing in money while you're already extra conning the people you've started to con? Like, he's a giant scam artist. And that's what a lot of the movement of the plot is focused on, trying to perpetuate this scam long enough for it to actually work.
True. And even when you were talking about the introduction, I thought the introduction is a very good example of how the movie flows. So the introduction of the film, when you're obviously you've met, you know, Buster Moon, and he decides he's going to do this big old thing. He's going to do this singing competition. They add the extra zeros on, and it's a huge, the flyers go out the window, everything you see in the trailer.
Mm-hmm, right.
And then all of a sudden the camera like zooms all over town to each individual person.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And it's like, wait. So then why is this? Why is he like that? Well, wait. Cause, and it just, it lifts off and it zooms to the next character, and it gives you about 3 to 5 seconds on them. And then it lifts off and it zooms to another character, and you are automatically introduced quickly in rapid succession
all the main characters
that you're supposed to be investing in.
You get a glimpse into their life before they try out.
But it's a very quick glimpse. It's not even enough to be like,
Well, it's made to be kind of almost like, I know that you don't do this anymore in cars, but older cars, young ones, bear with us. In an older car, you would physically turn the dial to tune the radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And so stations would go out and then another one would come in. And so that's kind of how that sequence works. It's like you're tuning out of one song and into another song, and the other song is connected to this other character's life. So you're also physically, visually zipping around town.
Yeah.
You know, to the other character, to, you know, like Rosita the Pig singing Firework by Katy Perry for
her 25 kids.
10 seconds, and then it zips over to somebody else.
Yeah. Or you get the glimpse that everybody sees in the trailer, the little snippet of Taron Egerton's Johnny, the gorilla,
as
he's playing lookout for his dad's gang, which pretty much the way it plays out in the film is exactly how it plays out in the trailer. So if you've seen the trailer, you know that scene.
You know his storyline, basically.
And then you're introduced to Seth MacFarlane's character, the rat, which I know he's a mouse, but seriously, the dude was a jerk.
Yeah, from the first moment you meet him,
you're right.
He's playing a saxophone, so at least you don't know for about the first 2 seconds that he's going to be a total jerk.
Yeah, for like the first second and a half, maybe even less than that, because somebody drops a penny in, and then he gets all like jerkish and like, is that all you got?
That's all the money you have? I was trained at this expensive music school. you owe me more. And he goes and basically steals the man's cash wad.
He robs the monkey.
And then shames him in front of all the other people on the like train platform.
Yeah.
And the guy like apologizes and walks away.
And then, so...
You're right, he's a rat.
I think we've talked about Illumination and how they kind of really try to reach out, almost like how DreamWorks did back with like Shrek and all those films.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a scene in that there's a line in that particular scene that I was like, really, Illumination? Really? So when the mouse is kind of pulling all the stuff out of his pockets, like he's literally digging into the monkey's pockets.
He empties the monkey's pockets.
And he finds an asthma inhaler, and then he says, hey, what do you smoke out of this? And I was like, seriously?
Too grown up.
Yeah. So the film's introduction really kind of sets the tone for the rest of the film, because you're getting all this all at once and you're expected to obtain it, so that as soon as you actually see these characters interact and all come together, you're like, okay, I know where these people are from. But I don't know, if it had cut the cast list down to maybe 3 instead of like the 5 or the 6, however many there was, I honestly probably would have been a little bit more invested.
Yeah, I think that they're just trying to juggle too much. Yeah. And unfortunately, that it moves. The story moves. It doesn't bog down
the
forward momentum of the story, but it really diminishes the entertainment value, I think, overall, of the experience of the film.
I agree 100%.
Because you do get these, early on, you get glimpses of what these voices sound like, and then you don't get to hear them until the very end. I mean, you get to hear them in little itty-bitty teeny-tiny snatches, but most of it is people talking, and quite frankly, that's not why I went to this movie. Similar to watching The Voice, or back in the day, watching American Idol, you know, or America's Got Talent, or whatever, the reason that I'm turning on the television is to hear people perform songs, to hear them sing. Same thing with this movie. I wanted to know, like, what does Reese Witherspoon's voice sound when it's partially auto-tuned? Like, how many songs does she do? Scarlett Johansson, she plays the punk rock porcupine, you know, who has the jerk boyfriend that, you know, starts getting fresh with a different porcupine when the koala only wants her and not the both of them to, you know, be part of this competition, you know? And, you know, so it's sort of like the stories all have merit. If it was a kid's cartoon show, absolutely follow every storyline, except maybe, again, not as much of the, like, fraudulent loan scamming angle. That's for grown-ups. That's not for kids.
Yeah. Or the gang kind of perspective from Johnny's dad and whatnot, and that whole. So we'll get into it a little bit later.
And surprisingly, I left the theater wanting more Gunther, which going into this film, I was like, that's the character I'm going to hate the most. He's the flamboyant pig that Rosita actually ends up being paired up with. Yeah. I thought going in that they were the husband and wife somehow, but she essentially makes a robot overnight to care for her entire family, her husband and their 25 little swine children.
Apparently she had a degree from MIT or something.
Yeah, like super great robotics program that she graduated from. And so she builds a robot that takes care of her whole family and her whole household as she goes and practices. And the koala has paired up her voice with the flamboyance of this other pig named Gunther, who can't really sing very well, but is like super gregarious and watchable. And ironically enough, he's been in all the commercials. I haven't liked him from day one. Nope. And I left the theater thinking, man, this movie could have used more Gunther. And that's because, quite frankly, he brought an element of fun, and he brought an element of this is a kid's cartoon movie to the film that was mostly not there. It was actually more serious in many respects than I expected it to be.
Yeah. And I think one of the standout roles for me personally had to have been Taron Egerton's Johnny. Not for the fact that, I mean, the storyline might by itself is very adultish. It's very grown up. It's really reaching to where, you know, your father is a criminal who ends up getting caught, disowns you while you're visiting him in jail, and then breaks out of jail so that he can see you later on. It's like, I think I could probably see that work in maybe a more, you know, mature storyline.
Yeah, but or if it had more room. I mean, like you said, if they had only 3 contestants instead of, well, 5 acts, but six contestants, because mm-hmm. Gunther and Rosita are a combo.
Yeah.
You know, so they've got five acts, plus the koala and his chameleon receptionist person and his best friend who has access to money.
Yeah.
From the old llama grandmother who used to own the place, who when she was young was voiced by
Jennifer Hudson,
who was phenomenal. I was like, the movie started with a number from Jennifer Hudson, mm-hmm. and I was like, ooh, I didn't know Jennifer Hudson was in this movie. And she's not really. She's in the beginning, that very beginning number, and then
bye-bye.
Then the next time you meet that character, she's older, and you know, it's not the same voice, but
definitely not the same.
But I think you're right, though, in the sense that if they had fewer characters that they were like hardcore following, you can mm-hmm. have other contestants. I'm surprised that they had only five acts. I was expecting the weird bunnies that, you know, the baby got back and whatever. Like,
yeah.
I thought the bunnies were going to be part of it. They have this little red panda quintet from Japan that's like, you know, cutesy little J-pop or whatever. And I thought they were going to maybe stay in it for a little while, or the, you know, the opera mountain ram goat thing or whatever, camel or whatever it was. Like, it would be fine if there were other acts and then you only follow, you know, this select few because they have the interesting stories, but they whittled it down to too many select few.
Yeah.
And I agree. Johnny would have been an interesting one to follow because, as with so many stories that are perfect for kids, he's trying to be his own person and not be forced to make the same mistakes that his elders mm-hmm. have made and are even pressuring him into. And so to see more of his journey, more of his decision making, and more of his angst even would have been rewarding, but you don't really get to because he's one small part of a very large pie.
And that's one of the things that Disney does really well. Disney has no problem in incorporating a lot of very quirky characters, a lot of interesting side characters, but they're not a part of the main plot.
Mm-hmm.
You take, for instance, Zootopia. Zootopia was mostly Nick Wilde and Judy Hopps. Now, you had the captain, who is voiced by Idris Elba,
mm-hmm.
but he's not fully a part of the overall story. You don't see him just about
every other scene. There when he needs to be.
Exactly. Or you take Claude Hopper, or whatever his name is, the cheetah that worked at the reception mm-hmm. desk for the... You know, a lot of people liked him, and he was funny. He was you know, cutesy and whatnot in the times being, but it wasn't in every scene. He wasn't there constantly. You weren't worried about having to overinvest in all these different people because you didn't know at one point in time when they're like fully, you know, their full role is going to be fully revealed, and you're like, oh, so the Clodhopper guy is actually working for this person and this person, blah, blah, blah. It minimizes the amount of knowledge that you as a viewer have to know so that you're focused on the people whom they want you to focus on.
Well, and it's interesting too because overall, the takeaway you get is if I'm a kid and maybe I really enjoy singing, whether I'm good at it or not, doesn't matter. I really enjoy it. My takeaway from this movie is, oh, I'm not going to be a good singer until I have bad stuff happen to me.
Mm.
Truly, I mean, like, you've got the porcupine, her boyfriend cheats on her and then breaks up with her. She has to break up with him, and then he doesn't support her until maybe a little bit in the
end.
This
is
actually in the film. Right? in the film. The gorilla, his father is a gangbanger and tries mm-hmm. to, like, jump him into the gang and then disowns him when he decides to not break the law. Well, he decides to go practice music and, you know, whatever. But you've got the stay-at-home mom with mm-hmm. lots of responsibilities at home, and her only way of living out her dream is to create a robot to care for her family, essentially. And she's all angsty about it the whole time. Like, mm-hmm. she doesn't know if she should be there or whatever. The mouse is the only one who kind of has this bravado, but then he has this whole weird, like...
He's a schmuck.
Russian bear, you know... Mafia after him because he keeps spending money he doesn't have.
And he cheats them in a poker game.
Right.
They're like gambling he's and he's still
not a likable character. And then you've got Mina, the elephant, voiced by Tori Kelly, who really is kind of the shining star of the mm-hmm. whole piece. She has the biggest number in the end, of course. And she's the one who has to come out of her shell the most because mm-hmm. she has a big, great voice and her family knows it and tries to encourage her. Encourage, I say that light, you know, loosely, because, again, they're encouraging her, but they're incredibly aggressive, overbearing, and even belittling. Like, the grandfather basically makes fun of her.
Yeah.
For not following through on the talent in her voice and for being having the stage fright. So it's sort of like if I'm a kid and I'm watching all of this happen, basically what I learn is being a performer requires, you know, a lot of sorrow and suffering and regret and a lot of bad experiences and emotions before you're considered good. And I don't know. I'm not a parent, but if I were a parent and I saw this with a young child, if that's my teenager needing to kind of get a window into, I don't know, like how the real world works, fine. If you're a 6-year-old or a 4-year-old or an 8-year-old, I don't need you to know about bank loan defrauding and how to swindle the Russian mob and all this intense pressure that goes into true art. Like, I don't need you to know that. I need you to go and enjoy it and have fun and walk out feeling like it's okay for you to enjoy singing.
True. And kind of going back to Zootopia, that kind of lends to the simplistic mindset of that film in terms of, well, if that's what you want to be, then do it. You know, if you want to do these things, you can do it. You know, and you go out and do it. This one is kind of like you were saying, if you want to be a singer, if you want to achieve greatness, if you want to be able to fulfill your dreams, you first got to go through the trenches before you get to that, that victory. And it really does lay it on heavy, like big time, because you have Mina, the main individual, who's just
the elephant, the young elephant,
the main young elephant who has the big number at the end. And you have this just guilt-ridden, moments in the film where she's like, well, I don't know if I want to, but I should. And then her parents think that, or her family thinks that she's, in the competition and she's just a stagehand.
Right.
And, there's all these different things that are going on, mentally and psychologically. And I think that might have been a little too much for a lot of the story.
And all of these characters have their own story and they're going through stuff. And near the end of it, in their what's going to be essentially their dress rehearsal before a public performance, they're rehearsing for this this older performer who has a lot of money and might be able to help fund the show for a longer period of time.
Jennifer Hudson character.
Yeah, the one that Jennifer Hudson did the song in the beginning, and now it's voiced by Jennifer Saunders as an older llama, excuse me. And so they're performing for her as kind of their last dress rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And you see a little bit behind stage about how they've built some camaraderie with each other.
Yeah.
There was far too little of that in this movie. Like, this movie was far too much every man for himself in life, not even in the competition. In the competition, they were actually friendly toward each other and everybody wanted everybody else to succeed. Mm-hmm. But in life, everything was so hard and myopic that you only focused on that character's story. That character could only focus on their own story. So you didn't even get to see a lot of them working together to solve a problem, which is extremely common in kids' movies. Like, everybody work together and we'll come to a better solution than if you had to figure it out by yourself.
True. The only person in the entire film who actually gets some type of social kind of intervention is Ash, the porcupine, mm-hmm. punk rock porcupine, because she ends up breaking down during the course of a rehearsal, and they end up like comforting her because this is right after her boyfriend cheats on
two-timed,
her,
and then
he ends up getting kicked out. So that's the only time anybody's actually in the group is invested in their lives outside of the music competition. Nobody knows that Johnny's dad is in jail.
Is in jail, right?
Nobody knows that Rosita is a neglected housewife who has too many kids that she can handle, and she had to create a robot to feed them all and get them out of the house. Nobody knows that Mina suffers from, being an introvert, and
nobody
and
knows that she can sing.
Nobody
as
knows
good
that
as
she
can
sing. That's
because
right.
Because she got too scared to perform and the mouse kicked her off the stage during her audition.
Yeah, the jerk mouse.
And he gets way too much screen time, by the way.
He does.
I do enjoy Seth MacFarlane's performing voice, very Frank Sinatra, very crooner, very old school, very stylish and classy, but the character himself had way too much screen time for as unlikable as he is.
Yeah, and he's very much about himself. For him being like the size of like a pill bottle, the dude was all about himself. and you're right. Seth MacFarlane has always excelled in his vocal abilities in terms of singing. I'm not talking about his cartoons and whatnot. But I mean, he's done some stints where he's actually sung on stage mm-hmm. with Frank Sinatra Jr. Or he did a holiday special at one point in time. So the man knows his way.
Well, he did. Didn't he do like the Golden Globes or the People's Choice or something a few years ago? And he basically sang with all of the musical acts a little bit.
Oh, wow.
All throughout the evening.
Well, yeah. See, there you go. So that there's no shortage of in terms of talent. It's unfortunately how his character was written for him. I think that if Seth MacFarlane had a little bit more of like a weigh in on the character itself and kind of gave a little bit more of like, well, maybe we should lean more this way. Maybe we should give him a little bit of a sense of redemption, because there is no redemption for this character.
No, I don't there's care really how the nothing film ends. That works for him. I mean, it's okay. And then he sings at the end too.
Yeah.
But he hasn't like improved.
No, he's still like a jerk.
And you spent a third of the story with him.
All the way up until
which
about...
Which is like, why he's the one that really needs to show change, because you've wasted so much time with him already that he needs to have a change of heart for it to be worth it. And it just
and
didn't...
It doesn't. Not
work out
all.
That way.
Yeah. I really... Now that we're thinking about it, now that we're talking about it, I really didn't like him. I don't know. I could see that they wanted to have a heel.
Well, and you're not meant to. I mean, he's meant to be unlikable.
But
the ones that you're meant to like, you don't get to spend very much time mm-hmm. with them.
Yeah, and you're stuck on this guy who's trying to woo a woman and realizes that he can't do anything without money, so he takes out a loan from the bank, and he's all of a sudden now he has money, and he can walk into any club and pick up the girl that he wants, and he cheats people, the Russian bear mob, in poker games, and I just...
Yeah, but then somehow they're still the bad guys because they're bears.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's... he actually cheated them and stole their money and is riding around in a big expensive car that he doesn't have the money for.
Exactly.
He was a street performer.
And the way the film ends, it gives no, like, sense of closure to
no.
that. No. Because you're literally left with him being rescued by the girl that he had just met, like, a day earlier in his car... saying, oh, it doesn't get any closer than that, or he says something cliche, and there's a bear hanging off of the back of the car. So little do we know, as the audience, that, oh, maybe they went off screen somewhere, and the bear climbed into there and tore him apart. I mean, who knows? I mean, the bear is trying to eat the mouse the entire, you know.
Yeah, because he did him wrong.
And he did him wrong.
He's a mouse, and this guy's a bear. And a Russian bear at that. I mean, come on. No, it's there is a lot to enjoy about the film.
Yeah.
Especially in terms of the way that it kind of shows a little bit of behind the scenes, like what would go into a show like that, a singing competition, live theater performance, and how each person has to rise to the challenge and the occasion and all of those things. But for all that it shows that's positive, there is an awful lot of just unnecessary negative. You know, it's not that everything in a cartoon movie has to be sunshine and roses. But when all you're focusing on are some disreputable actions and then a few bright spots of people truly doing the right thing, but they're kind of on the fringe.
Yeah.
It's harder to root for the movie as a whole. You root for them as characters, but you don't root for the movie as a whole. I would listen to this soundtrack a dozen times before I would watch the movie again.
And that's one of the things that the film does do correct. Not in the film itself, but there are some original songs that the film has put out.
Mm-hmm.
You heard one of them earlier, which was the intro to this segment. I mean, they've even had a stint on Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah, they did a special little kind of Brady Bunch style performance of Wonderful Christmas Time, where they actually had Paul McCartney was eventually one of the faces in the square, and then Jimmy Fallon and the Roots, and then you had some of the cast members, not all of them, but you had Matthew McConaughey, Reese Witherspoon, Seth MacFarlane, Tori Kelly, I think that might, Scarlett Johansson.
As their characters.
That you had them, just the performers' faces singing, and then sometimes they switched in for their characters back and forth. So it was really fun, very colorful, and, you know, it's a Christmas song. I mean, what's not to love? But it was the actual, you know, it was those actors performing the vocals.
Very true. So, in conclusion to this whole thing, and mind you, we're not trying to rain on anybody who says that they like this film. We are the filmlosophers. We try to look deeper than just what most people see on the surface, and that's how we see this film. And you know, we'll give our honest opinion about it. So, but Final impression, Chad? Does it pass, and how many monocles?
Okay, so because the musical numbers, when they do happen, are really impressive, I would say on account of the musical performances, it passes, because that's what I went to watch anyway. Mm-hmm. I wanted to hear, like, well, what do they sound like when they're singing? And I would say, I'd probably split it 50-50. It's got to be a 2.5 really? Out of 5 for me, yeah.
Well, for me...
Because the story, to me, like, the story has to really... If you're going to interrupt what people are expecting the movie to be, if you're going to interrupt it with a very heavy-handed story, it better be a really darn good one.
Yeah.
And it just, to me, it wasn't.
True. Very, very true.
It wasn't worth preempting what I went there to see.
Yeah. For me, it passes because of the fact that I could see the potential... For what I had hoped, and for what I did gather out of it, this film could have easily been an hour and 10, an hour and 20, as opposed to an hour and 50 minutes. And I probably could have still came out with a better, maybe even a better reaction to it. So it does pass for me for the hopes of what it could be. And in terms of the film, how many monocles, I probably would have to go down to a 2. Because out of all the performances, there was maybe one or two that I actually really enjoyed. The rest of them were just like, eh. I mean, that's what YouTube's for. So, you know, but that does bring us...
Yeah, but you're not going to, like, get those people to just perform for a YouTube video.
You never know. There's YouTube.
I mean, some of them. Tori Kelly obviously came from YouTube, but...
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That the rest of them, I don't know.
You never know. But that does bring us to a brand new special segment called...
Keep the change, you filthy animal.
That's right.
That was clever.
Thank you.
That was clever. Good job.
John Hughes and Christopher Columbus included a notorious and fake gangster flick in their holiday classic, Home Alone, as well as Home Alone 2 Lost in New York.
Yep.
So we thought it was fitting to incorporate the famous line as our special segment lead-in. In the film, Macaulay Culkin's Kevin McAllister indulges in a little bit of extra junk food and forbidden film viewing, and we thought it might be fun to take a peek behind the curtain to figure out if there were any overindulgent moments in this week's film. So, Chad, why don't you go ahead and kind of lay out the land that we got going on here?
Overindulging. So basically, you know, in Home Alone, Kevin is home alone, and so he takes the opportunity to do things that he's not normally supposed to do. He eats extra junk food, extra pizza, spends money that isn't his,
sounds like
watches
kind of
this movie that he's not supposed to watch.
This filth.
Filthy animal. It's a gangster film. So in terms of this story, Sing, this film, are there any things that the filmmakers overindulge on? And I think that for me, the biggest thing, which we've been talking about already, is how do you balance the narrative, the story, versus the musical performances, when quite frankly this is American Idol as a cartoon movie with animals instead of people.
Very
but
true.
The way that it's marketed, the way that it's titled Sing, not Talk, not Bank Repossession, not Save the Theater. Like, it's titled Sing, and I think one thing that I would say this movie, the filmmakers overindulged on in making this film, was they made a story that was way more complicated than it needed to be, and they could have done probably twice as many musical numbers, given that they don't ever... Until the end, you don't get a complete song. Mm-hmm. You get little snatches of songs.
True.
Including Jennifer Hudson in the beginning. She doesn't give you a whole song.
No.
They had her sing like half of a song. And
yeah,
that was the heyday of the theater, right?
Yeah.
And so I think you could have done twice as many of those little snatches of songs to show, you know, the mindset of the characters, the motivation, maybe their development, as, you know, professionals, let's say, as they're practicing, like, how are they getting better? You don't know, because you don't see them getting better.
True.
Aside from arguably the gorilla, you see him fighting to learn to play the piano really, really well. He knew basics and didn't know a lot of the flourishes. And so you see a little bit of his piano playing, but that's not singing. That's not his, you know, performance persona or whatever you'd call it. And I think that, given our familiarity with American Idol, The Voice, etc., it would have been much more fulfilling to see some of those elements in cartoon form than some of the more adult skewing themes that kind of just bogged down the story to me.
True. And it's similar to like a lot of the modern day musicals that you see now, or just even musicals in all past time. You take the idea of what a musical is, and that's what this film was being marketed as, a musical. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, you know, music is, you know, there's singing in introspective parts. There's singing mm-hmm. when there's, you know, good times, bad times. You're singing when just about every opportunity is there, you know, that you can incorporate a song. You know, it's all about the music. And this film kind of takes that left turn and it's like, okay, so the music part, the singing part, it only happens during the competition. Right. So, you know, right. and it kind of just, it throws you out of it. So I agree with you wholeheartedly that the film really kind of misleads people who are seeing a lot of the promotional material, and you're like, okay, cool. This is like, you know, this is like every, like you were saying, every singing competition show that everybody likes, the reality TV shows, but put into like the Zootopia world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're hoping to get something like that.
Well, and to your point, that's what makes a musical so interesting and unique, is that the songs communicate the story. You don't use a random song, you know. That Katy Perry Fireworks song for Rosita's introduction was not randomly selected because it was a popular song 4 years ago or 5 years ago, whenever it came out. It was selected because that character feels trapped in her situation mm-hmm. and she wants to show the world that there's more to her than washing dishes and preparing sack lunches and mending clothes, you know. And so there's a story, you're communicating story through that.
Yeah.
And for a movie called Sing, they should have gone in that direction more often.
Another one that we actually mentioned while we were doing our review was the number of plot lines. You look at the film, and like we were saying, you have about 6 to 7 plot lines that you are set to invest into, and you're meant to invest into it because of the fact that they're key people throughout the entire film.
Right.
I honestly thought I was watching, you know, It's a Wonderful Life meets 8 Mile meets, you know, because I was like, Taron Egerton
all,
is like...
All with the window dressing of American Idol.
All of them like just thrown onto American Idol. And it's like, I like those films individually. I like what makes those films so great individually. But you have all these different elements thrown into a film and you're expecting young people to really kind of catch wind of what you're really trying to serving. It's like serving a filet mignon to a 5-year-old. You're giving them something great, but they don't know how to process
half
this.
Half of it gets thrown on the floor.
Exactly. And that's what happens with this film. You have a lot of great characters. You have great potential for what could be great characters.
Mm-hmm.
But that's never fulfilled. That's never manifested. And what you're left with is like a good slash great performance at the end and a half, you know, completed character's arc, you know?
Yeah, I would definitely, in terms of overindulgence and, you know, trimming it down, I think your point from earlier was very apt in that you're following too many characters. Mm-hmm. You should limit it to 3 plus the koala, right? So I would definitely do Johnny, Rosita, and Mina.
Yeah.
I thought they had the most, nothing against Mike, except everything against Mike. The only thing he had going for him was his voice. The crooner, you know, and nothing against the porcupine, but she was there to give like a punk rock angle.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, her story wasn't as interesting Mm-mm. as the other three to me.
No, it's true.
So I definitely would have narrowed down the focus of the story by focusing on those three characters and maybe the koala, but not as much. I wouldn't have done as much of Buster Moon's, the rise and fall and rise again of Buster Moon. Like,
yeah.
He's a koala. He's cute. He sleeps in a drawer in his own desk in his own office. And that's, you know, adorable and everything. But that's all I really need to know.
True.
Other than that, I mean, I don't know. Let him be a warmer Simon Cowell.
Yeah.
And that's all you need him for. You don't need the story to be his story. And in many cases, this was.
And true to what you're saying right now, people already know Simon Cowell. You don't have to create or develop a character
right.
to have somebody seem like Simon Cowell. There's already a Simon Cowell out there. All you have to do is just emulate everything that he does already.
But in a friendlier
but
way.
But in a friendlier way.
Kid-friendly way.
Exactly. And if you want to give him a moment of redemption at the end of the film, that's fine. That's a very one-dimensional story arc, and you can deliver on that because people are already they don't have to invest too much into it because they already know, oh, yeah, this is where they're going. Yeah. Oh, that's like the mean guy on American Idol, blah, blah, blah. So,
and the rest of it is these contestants and their stories.
Exactly.
Yep.
And then, of course, the last one in our special segment, vocal talents. Were they wasted or put to good use?
That's a really interesting, challenging question because I don't know that you necessarily got everything that you could have gotten from any of them. You know, somebody like Tori Kelly is a recording artist.
Yeah.
Right? Jennifer Hudson only really essentially did a vocal cameo in the beginning, but she is a recording artist and Broadway star and film star. And, you know, but then you've got your surprise factors like Reese Witherspoon and Taron Egerton.
Well, the big and, surprise for me.
Yeah, huge surprise, right? Yeah. Now, his was pretty auto-tuned, but, you know, still, I mean, he sang the right notes. They just, to give it a certain quality, they got to tweak it. Seth MacFarlane was fantastic.
Yeah.
If his character was completely different, I totally would have kept him around. But the fact that he sings so well and he is so smarmy and doesn't change really kind of like it almost reflects poorly upon the singing to
it
me.
It does. And in that same case, I wasn't a huge fan of Reese Witherspoon's character because it just, like you said, I don't think we got the most out of what could have been a great character. We didn't get the most out of what could have actually flourished in a musical production, in a singing performance. You know, likewise with, sad to say, I think Tori Kelly was the only one that was really put on stage and put out there to perform as best as she could.
Right.
Because Taron Egerton's song at the end was, all right. I mean, I personally would have liked to hear him do something else or even something that's actually, you know, in the trailers. And then you have Scarlett Johansson, which everybody knows Scarlett Johansson has done music before. She's done rock music. She's been a part of, you know, bands and whatnot.
Right.
So this isn't too much of a stretch, but I don't think music is her forte. Not to be rude or anything, but I don't think that this is where her bread and butter is going to come from, you know. So, yeah.
Well, just, and even, I mean, her character is not that style of music, and the way the character's arc was going, it wasn't meant to be one of the wow moments. You know, it was a fun, solid performance, and she threw her quills all over the place out of excitement and or frustration as a porcupine.
Which is scary because I right. I was like, oh my gosh, she's gonna impale somebody coming through this.
I mean, really, you've got the pig who comes out of her shell and becomes a performer. And so that's a big moment. That's a reveal, right? That's a character change moment. You've got the teenage boy who said no to the gang so that he could play the piano and sing on stage. That's a reveal. That's a big moment. I've changed the trajectory of my life, right? And you've got your stage fright, big voice, you know, the elephant who is like basically cannot stand on a stage and look at people without like fainting and running away, and she has the biggest moment of all, which is, you know, really exciting and great. Now the movie did have that. I thought that her story was pretty complete.
Oh yeah.
It was the other two, you know, transformation stories I could have done with, you know, having a little bit more of those.
Yeah. And primarily, like we said earlier, those three. You know, whittling out everything else that just wasn't important. The Mike the Mouse and, everything else. So, but that about wraps up another great show here. And if you have any comments or suggestions about us or about the show, drop us a line on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and drop us a line on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. We've had a great conversation, and you know what? We can't wait to get back to you in the new year.
That's
as this
right.
is our last show of 2016.
Farewell, farewell.
And good riddance 2016, because we
in with the new.
Exactly. So you know what? This was an awesome talk. This was an awesome conversation. We really got into it, and we hope that you enjoyed it. So, from all of us here at the Film Philosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.